Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's trying to save the world, but the world isn't trying to save him. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much. Oh, no, look, what a disaster. How professional. Welcome, my fine friends, to the Leicester Square Theatre and Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to some people on Twitter the other day, which, you know, at the moment is still an ongoing thing. By the time this goes out, I'm pretty sure will be a retro. That will be a very retro reference. People go, oh, yeah, remember that? It's a couple of months away to broadcast, so I think it'll be dead by then. And some racist people and Elon Musk call it Rahulistopo. So I don't know if that's going to... That's all that's left. It is. It's lovely to be here. I've cut my finger there. Look at that. Yeah, I cut it. I was washing up a tin can so I could recycle it. Why does bad things happen to good people? I was trying to save the world. I do so much to say the world's going to end. Apparently, it's too late. So you know, don't worry about it. Well, I'm the only person I know who takes all the plastic wraps off things that say you can recycle at big supermarkets and actually takes them to big supermarkets. I must be the only person who does it because there's only one bin at every supermarket and it's usually quite full and there's the slot. You can only put one thing through at a time. It's like they don't want to recycle that stuff. That's one. But I do it because I'm trying to save the world. So I'm a good guy. I've been up in Yorkshire this week. I did a lovely gig at the Leeds Wardrobe of Can I Have My Ball Back? Kahima Bubba. Probably won't catch on. which I'm hoping to tour in 2024. Probably after the tour of this, which I'm touring. Do go to richherring.com/Rahulistopo. You can see all the places I'm coming to. Do come along if you can. I went to see York City, who are magic, play Middlesbrough. It's a big pre-season match. It was a 0-0 draw. Pretty exciting. They're good, though. I'm going to confidently predict York City get promoted this season. You see if I'm wrong. I said at the beginning of 2020, I've got a feeling this is going to be a great year. My prediction skills are terrific, so do watch out for that. Right, look, we've got an absolutely amazing guest for you this week. I'm not going to waste any more time with my ad-lib nonsense. He is probably best known for playing the Wazir in Carry On Columbus, probably the most popular Carry On film the one people talk about in it. Will you please welcome the incredible Nigel Planer, ladies and gentlemen. The Wazir. The Wazir. Thank you very much. Welcome. Yeah, we've made it deliberately difficult for you. It's a trap. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Good. Do people stop you in the street and say it's you, the Wazir from Carry On Columbus, every day?
Every day, yes.
Every day.
I get it all the time.
Yeah. Happy memories of the Carry On Columbus shoot?
Yes. What a terrible film that. So, but it was only one day.
Oh, you did one
I
day.
Did. Yeah. I only did one day. And I was Rick's Wazir.
Right.
And Rick was having a great time being the Sultan or whatever he was playing. And I felt, I don't know if any of you have seen the film, I felt he was the only guy who gave it what it deserved, a proper bit of carry on with lots of innuendos and completely over the top stuff.
Yeah.
And everybody else, I think, was completely miscast. It had Alexei Sale,
yeah.
Peter Richardson playing meant to be playing a sort of saucy fellow with a glum look on his face, like, why have I agreed to do this? And Jim Dale was good. He was Jim Dale. He was doing Jim Dale, and that's wonderful.
But even by then, most of the main cast of the Karen films had died, sadly, hadn't they? So there were, Jim Dale was probably the only one still
around now, isn't he?
He's still going.
Yeah, yeah.
Immortal.
But it wasn't...
Dick-a-dum-dum, dick-a-dum-dum.
What's that?
He wrote Dick-a-dum... I think he did. I think he wrote Dick-a-dum-dum, dick-a-dum-dum.
Oh, did he?
I think so, yeah.
He wrote, Hey there, Georgie girl.
Did he? Let's talk about Jim Dale for an hour.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Let's get Jim. I wonder if I should have got Jim Dale on.
Yeah.
He does going to talk about
He does a lot of really good funny walks as well.
Does he?
He does a one-man show where he shows his wiggle hips funny walk that he did as a kid.
Yes.
Well, he's a proper entertainer, Jim Dale.
He's a proper entertainer. It's a shame, though, isn't it? Because, you feel like... I guess it was maybe a little bit too early to do it because there were still, some of the originals around and working. But you feel like there could have been a fantastic new generation of Carry On-esque or British comedy films with that amazing 1980s, 1990s crew of people.
Yeah, but it's the sort of innuendo, the whole thing when the crew that we had with Alexei and Peter, myself, the only person who had the courage to actually go for... as I said, the sexism and the, there's a lovely pair and, all that's what a Carry-On film's about. It's all got to be innuendo. And, we were meant to be, non-racist, non-sexist comedians.
Yeah.
And it just, that's gone out of fashion. And Rick was the only one who actually grabbed it by the, and went for it. And as a result, he's funny in that film.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody else is.
I must give it a watch. I haven't seen it yet. So I was saving up. Never got past Carry On Emmanuel. That was the... I had to take a rest after that one. It's what killed most of the cast, I think, Carry On Emmanuel.
Carry On Emmanuel. I've never heard of that one.
Oh, yeah, it's bad. Have you thought Carry On Columbus was bad?
Really?
Kenneth Williams is in it, but really does not want to be in. I mean, really doesn't want to be in.
But I mean, there's a thought. Did any of them actually want to be in them in the first place? You hear stories of them afterwards, and they were reluctant about their acting careers.
Yeah.
Going into Carry On, which was two-dimensional caricatures, wasn't it?
Well, it's difficult. It's the difficult thing for anyone who's was successful, obviously in the 60s, and some of those early Carry On films are quite subtle and
are they
character driven? Yeah, there's some of the early ones are.
Go on,
are
name
pretty good.
One.
I think Carry On Constable is quite a good, and I don't know if there's a joke in the title there, but I think is quite a good show. And the Carry On Spying, is it the early one? That's a pretty good one.
Right. I'm not a Carry On expert.
I like Carry On Screaming, but that's a later one. Carry On Screaming is a very good one. But yeah, I mean, Kenneth Williams did enjoy it. But then, you get typecast into something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, that was something that must have been a fear for you, because you had an early success with a character that we all still talk about, and the young ones we still talk about.
You have gone on,
I think, to show that there's a lot more to you than that. But if you'd ended up just playing Neil for the last 30, 40 years, Kenny Williams had to end up playing
Kenny
Williams.
I'd be quite wealthy.
Do you think people will still be paying for it? Here he comes again. his final comeback to A Hole in My Shoe. Here we go. but it's a danger, isn't it? As a comedy actor, comedy performer, you want to do something successful that everyone knows and loves for the rest of your life, which you've done several times over, I'd say. But there's there's that flip side that for Kenneth Williams, more than anyone, who saw himself as a fantastic actor. He sort of got pigeonholed into something.
And Harry H. Corbett. I don't know if you remember him from Steptoe and Son. The son in Harry H. Corbett was he had just done a, seminal of a generation Richard III at the Royal Shakespeare or wherever, the equivalent of. And he was a proper actor.
Yeah.
And he got this part of in the Steptoe, Harold Steptoe, and that was it. And he wasn't happy about it, because that was the limit of it. And he did resent it the rest of his life, which is a shame, because you think it's so good.
It is so good. It goes two ways. I think we had Michael Palin on, and he was very happy to talk about all of his everything he did and quote sketches and stuff. And I think that's the way to go, really, isn't it? To be proud and pleased of what you've done and glad that people remember it and love it. But for Steptoe and Son is actually... I mean, Steptoe and Son's close to being as good as Richard III, I'm afraid, in reality.
Well...
I mean, no offence to Shakespeare, but he couldn't have done 80 episodes of fucking Richard III, could he?
I suppose not. Mind you, 80 episodes. We didn't get near that with the young ones. We only did six.
No, 12.
No, 12. 12.
16, sorry. It felt like six.
It's not a lot. It's a few weeks' work.
Yeah.
The way Adrian always describes it is, he was counting it up. He said, that's 3 months' work 43 years ago.
Yes.
So that's how he likes to think of it, because he likes to move on, put it in the past. Yeah. But it's quite an important 3 months' work.
But I was saying to backstage, for me, I'd love Monty Python and I'd loved Pete and Dud, and not the 9 o'clock news, to be fair, but they were mainly things that were like previous generations. But the young ones came along and it was ours, and that's what I think any comedian of my generation, the young ones was our thing, and it was mind-blowing and life-changing. And I think also led to, regular kids. I was growing up in Somerset, I'd said I want to be an actor or a writer to my careers advisor, and they said, well, you can't do that, you'll have to work in a bank. Well, I'm not going to work in a fucking bank. I'm definitely not doing that. But it wasn't. It felt like the punk movement of comedy, and it made comedy seem accessible to regular kids, I think. So it was massively important, I think, as a series.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here. Oh.
Yeah.
No, it's not worked out, but it is. We won't talk about it too much, because we did a lockdown chat together. I think it was the last remote lockdown chat. I think was you and me of the COVID period. We did talk a little bit about the young ones.
I can't remember what we talked about at all.
I can't remember.
So you can repeat yourself.
You can. Quite, it doesn't matter. I don't care.
I'll look a surprise. At all your questions.
I don't know if we talked about, because I was interested in how it came together, because it felt like, did someone decide to put you guys together, or did someone write this? They'd seen you all at the comic strip, presumably, and said, let's put you in.
It was kind of that. Paul Jackson was very instrumental in it, who was working at the BBC producing Top of the Pops. Is what he was producing at the time. And he came down the Comedy Store and he saw us all. And we were always hustling to get on telly. There was a programme called Friday Night and Saturday Morning. And Rick did a bit of Kevin Turvey on it. We were in our little slots. And yeah. I did, with Peter Richardson, we did The Outer Limits on that. So we had a little bit of taste of telly. And Paul Jackson came up with the best offer, which was something he called Boom Boom Out Go the Lights, where he took from the club and put us onto one of those TV light entertainment floors, you know, because the cameras have got to all slide around on this white light entertainment floor and everything's properly lit. And yeah. it kind of took an awful lot of the bollocks out of it. But we did two of those.
Yeah.
And so we stuck together. We were all talking about a house. Wouldn't it be good to do a house sitcom with the sketches so that each room would have a different one of our acts? There was Rick and Aid was one of the acts. Me and Peter was one of the acts. And then Rick and Lisa and Ben came up with the idea for calling it The Young Ones, that they're students, that Alexis the landlord. And so we all got to apply our acts on telly in a way that we considered viable rather than giving in to what the telly,
yeah.
the standard way of doing it on telly.
And it started together, I mean, it started together pretty well in terms, I guess, of you and Rick and Aid being, you know, not having worked together directly and then suddenly being...
Well, we'd been working together on tours as yeah. acts in the same show, in the yeah. comic strip show. But and we'd done sketches. We did something right. at a place called Pentameters, the four of us. So Peter, myself, Rick and Aid were already a sort of gang. We did a band called Nice Weather.
Okay.
Which is kind of a precursor. They were the hippie version of Bad News before they came along. And we did something else called Let's Going, which is a travel writer called Letts, Mr. somebody Letts. And we did, yeah, we were doing sort of sketches and tours. And one night I remember on a tour, either Rick or Adrian couldn't turn up. They were late in the train and I had to put the paper bag on my head for whatever routine it was and go out. So we were all in a gang, really.
Yeah. And it was an incredible time for comedy in terms of the alternative comedy boom that you were right in the center of Channel 4 kind of emerging at the same time.
Yeah, and,
The comic strip is, you know, that's one of my memories of the first day of Channel 4. The comic strip was Comic Strip 5 Go Mad in Dorset, but then all the other ones that came after that as well, which you're obviously at the center of as well.
Yeah. No, I'm not in that one, though.
No, not in that one, but you're at the centre of the comic strip.
In a way, it's good, because we got Ronald Allen to do the part that I would have done.
Yeah.
The old guy to play Uncle Quentin.
Yes.
And that's sort of Peter, in making those scripts, always sees me as the sort of the pervy uncle character.
Yeah. I'm that of my generation.
Is that who you are? Yeah. But... But I was unavailable. I was doing something called Shine on Harvey Moon at the same time. So it was quite a stressful time. I was in all three series at the same time, which meant timetables were quite difficult.
Yes. Well, you know, I don't want to talk about that too much, because I think there's so much other stuff that you've done. We did talk about Nicholas Craig a lot on the other podcast, and you've brought, I think that it maybe partly inspired you to do a podcast of...
Oh, Nicholas Craig, pod.com.
Yeah.
Yeah, but a podcast is like this, isn't it? It's just people talking forever and ever and ever.
It can be.
And I don't know, people listen to it, do they?
I don't know if they do. That's not really my concern.
But
I just put the stuff out. Some of them, Nigel, some of mine, they definitely don't listen to. But this one, I think they listen to a little bit.
Right, good. No, but the Nicholas Craig is more like a pod.com.
Yeah.
It's actually scripted and it's 6 half-hours, like a proper sitcom used to be.
Yeah.
It's 6 half-hours. It has a sort of developing story, nearly. where, you know, he starts in one position. Each episode, there's a little sort of hua thing that happens to him. He gets tricked out or something. And it was really good fun to make that. I did it when we were all locked down as well. I've got Anthony Heads on it,
yes,
playing Nicholas Craig's arch rival Anthony Head.
Right.
And it's quite fun. It's quite fun, you know, bitching about Anthony Head on your podcon. But yes, it's 6 half-hours, and it's ridiculous to do 6 half-hours on a podcast. You know, who's going to listen to it? I don't know how many listeners it's got.
But it's there, you know, people can find it, and people can find it. And, you know, it's sort of...
It is funny.
I think, but what's great about you and looking through your career, and it really, and today, really looking through it all again, it just made me realise is, you know, how you've reinvented yourself. You work in a lot of different disciplines. Obviously, you're a very good actor. You do musicals. You've come into sort of... You've written books before, but then now you started writing plays, some of them with Adrian. You've written, which we all talk about. You've written a fabulous book that's just come out. So you've been embraced as well by each generation. It's very easy, I think, for an actor to be, you know, have a brief period of going, of, you know, here I am, and then just they kind of disappear. But you've been, you know, you've been in Inside Number 9. You're in Mandy. You know, the new generations have all embraced you, and you're still doing fantastic work as an actor and a creative person. But I feel like it feels like you don't appreciate how good how much you've done. It still feels from interviews that you feel like your moment hasn't come. Do you think that's fair?
Well, yeah. Does that make me sound good or bad?
I don't know. I mean, I think it makes you sound like you don't appreciate what you've achieved, because even if you did, even if you'd stopped in 1983, that would still be a pretty impressive career. But you didn't, and you carried on and did, you know, and have done so many different things.
I suppose there's a feeling always of not being quite satisfied, which is good, because that's a drive.
Yeah.
So it's good. That's a good thing. But being kind of sour about everything is not so good, is it? So it's good and bad.
But if it's, but you know, most people wouldn't carry. Most people don't, you know, get into. I'm in my late 50s. You're a little bit older than I am.
I'm quite a lot older than you are. Yeah.
Most people of my age don't kind of push themselves out. If they get to a level where they go, okay, I'm happy here. We'll keep treading water here. It seems to me you keep pushing yourself and you keep trying different things. And you know, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yes, I do. I suppose. Low boredom and envy. You know, it's you know, to be honest, and I think most people are like this, but they don't admit it. It's sort of, why has he got that? You know, I want that.
Yeah,
and that drives a lot of people.
It does.
It's not just the money. I think why are they always giving Adrian, for example. Why are they giving him that part when, you know, I could have done that.
You could have been in Star Wars, right? You could have done Star Wars.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have wanted to. But no, I have got quite grown up about it now. And actually, Adrian and I mean, we're still writing together. So, and we're getting on pretty well.
Yeah.
But There's always that sort of thing of, oh, so you got that, did you? You're doing that, are you? So that means you can't write with me this week because you're in Chicago now, are you? Oh, great. And I think most people have a dose of that, really, if they were honest.
I think they do. I think a lot of comedy people do. I think they do, but I think also it sort of blinds them sometimes to how well they've done themselves, because you keep looking at someone else. There'll always be someone who you perceive as doing better than you are.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult, especially, you know, if you're a modest person, it's difficult to appreciate, you know, what you've done, I think.
The things I do take satisfaction out of, though, are maybe the odd things where I think, that was particularly difficult for me, that one, and I did that, and so I'm very pleased, and I'll come home at night and think, I did that, and that wasn't what people are expecting of me, or that's not,
yeah,
you know, that I've managed to come out with that. And then I do get a satisfaction out of that.
Yeah. And I would look at your career. You know, you've been in Inside Number 9, and most comedy people would, the people they've had in Inside Number 9 are absolutely incredible. You would dream of being in that show. That's amazing. Yeah. For me, Death in Paradise, I want to do that. I just mainly want the holiday, but it's not the point.
Yeah.
And I'm annoyed.
I think it is the point, actually.
It is the point. And I keep going on about it. I met the bloke who created Death in Paradise and told him I've watched every single episode of Death in Paradise.
Oh, really?
And he didn't go, oh, do you want to be in it? He goes, it's great you love it so much.
So which one?
Fucking put me in it.
Which one is your favourite, though?
Which one? I think Ralph Little is pretty good. Ardle was great as well.
Ardle was great.
You were in one of Ardle's.
I was with Ardle, yeah. He was getting a bit tired and mosquito bitten by the time I got there.
Yeah, you don't want to be the main guy in it.
Well, the main guy, they all have trouble with it, don't they? Yeah. They're months and months, and you've got to remember a different load of questions. It's that thing about being the detective.
Yeah.
You don't realise they've got to go, the 14th was the day that you disappeared from St. Christian's and you moved, of course, to Twickenham. Why did you do that on the 14th and not the 15th? You've got to have all this information while you're questioning them.
And it's just the same show over and over again. It's really difficult.
All that changes is what you've got to learn every week, and they have to learn it every week.
Yeah.
So I think it scrambles the brain of the main guy.
Yeah.
But if you're playing a guest baddie, it's good.
I find it's a very entertaining show. It does exactly what it needs to do.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to gather all the suspects together and I'm going to talk to them each, and they're going to wait until I've finished. And then when their game's up, they'll all go, oh, okay.
Yeah,
fair cop. And
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But yeah, there's some. Let's talk about the book, because I think there's a lot to talk about in the book. Jeremiah Born in Time. So tell us how this, because I'd listened to the you did an audio version of it. But you're telling me backstage the book came for hold it up, there you go. I paid for this book to be created,
because
it's an unbound book, so you could you put your money in and you wait a little while and then the book turns up. Quite a few years later.
Yes, a while later. But no, thanks for your support.
So my name's in the book, so I'm very
excited. Yeah, it is.
It's a time travel story, which I'm fascinated by time travel.
It's a sort of futuristic, historical, steampunk comedy. I'm not very good at genres. So I just shoved as many in as I could. I read nearly all of the Terry Pratchett books on audio.
Yeah.
And I used to really enjoy that. Big cast list of characters, lots of silly voices, and reading fast, not some sort of literature reading like an audio book, but literally just like you'd read it to your kids or something, just just enjoying the read.
Yeah.
And so I've written some books before, but I thought, why can't I write like that? So I've sort of been inspired by him in a way, and even to the extent that I've put pointless footnotes,
right,
and really sort of pedantic footnotes in the bottom, because I love his footnotes as well.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I thought I'll try and write in something that people might actually enjoy reading rather than some sort of soul-searching thing.
Yeah.
And it's set in three time zones. It's a time travel story, except it's slightly different from normal, because time travel normally means time and space, relativity. It means you can find yourself in another place. But in this version, it's much more like how I imagine, how it's in your imagination. So you don't travel in space, you travel in your memory. You can remember back somewhere and you can be there, but you're here. Time past is still here now with us.
Yes.
Like that thing, you know, if you've got I've put that cup there, and then I just go off and I come back and I think, I'm sure I put the cup there, but I can't see it on the table. Have you ever experienced that? Yeah. You've lost your specs and I know I put them on the table. And then fourth time you come back and they are there.
Yeah.
And you think, well, why couldn't I? Am I looking straight at them? or what? And I imagine that the past is like that. We're looking straight at it. And it'll appear. And that's the method of time travel.
Yeah.
Rather like an inherited memory that you might, like birds can fly south, or little beavers build a dam, even without having been near a river, if they've been brought up in a flat.
Right.
Saw this little video on Twitter. No, seriously, there was a video on Twitter just last week of a beaver that had been brought up in a flat, and the first thing it did when it could walk is build a dam in the flat.
Right.
So what's happening with our memory?
Yeah.
You know, what's happening? And so I was imagining in the future this inherited memory might get developed, and so people in the future can travel backwards. So it's set in the same place, Blackfriars Road, in 2019. Jeremiah Bourne's there, and 1910, where he goes back by accident, and 2123, where the world in 100 years' time is remarkably like the world nowadays, in that everyone's still bickering. The residents' association are still not getting on with each other. And because there's been a big digital meltdown, I was trying to think, how would you write a future thing? Are you going to put music, and is it going to be like Blake 7?
Yeah.
Or is it going to be like this? It's going to be shit like this, isn't it? You know. And so I imagined a day when all of the data has disappeared from one last click. Somebody, Jeffrey Pritchard, I've called him.
Okay, it's a good name.
Goes in to a bar in Bermondsey and goes through the usual, you know, to order a pint of beer, you know, password, advertising, program, get the new app, blah, 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 pint of beer, yes, please, click. And that is the final click.
Right.
And all, it's the day that the Internet of Things becomes the Internet of Nothing, and there's absolutely no data left.
Yeah.
And where would that leave us? So people with a memory, like a taxi driver, Jeremiah Bourne's mum is a taxi driver, and they have the knowledge. They actually, I read somewhere, can have bigger hippocampi.
That's right, yeah.
You know, yeah. Because they've trained, they have super memories.
Yeah.
So people in the future with big memories would suddenly become rather important. If we lost all, imagine if you've lost all the data,
yeah.
If everything was gone, we wouldn't know how to make anything, how to do anything, would we? Everything, you know, control your heating with data, everything.
I think increasingly, yeah. I mean, it is that is a sort of worry because everything's becoming digitalized, you know, and obviously anything that isn't digitalized, you know, won't last forever.
So in my future world, they're growing things again and they're going around on push-me-pull-you tracks on railways and bicycles. Somebody's remembered how to make bicycles. And they're all bickering. and that's quite fun. But they have developed their memories so they can travel in time.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea. And I think the way the time travel happens is, you know, you don't need a machine. It's just quite organic because it's connecting through the brain. So it sort of, you know, cuts out a lot of the faff. I'm quite obsessed with time travel stuff and what makes logical sense and what doesn't make logical sense and whether changing the past changes the future or not, or whether, you know, it's an ongoing thing. It's a really difficult genre to write well because you can get yourself caught up in...
changing the past. Well, that's what he's not meant to do, but he blunders around.
Okay.
Because he doesn't know where he's from. The clue is in the title, Jeremiah Born in Time. He's living with his stepfather and his mum has disappeared.
Yeah.
And I don't want to ruin the plot too much, but those are a few hints as to, the journey he's got to go on is to find out where and why his mum is and who he is, where he's from. It's not ruining it too much to say when he's from.
No. Okay.
Because he doesn't know when he's from.
No. It only just arrived. So I've only just started reading it. And I listened to the radio play that you did with Big Finish, but that's a little bit different than the...
The book came before that radio drama, and it's also called Jeremiah Born in Time. Yeah. We had a fantastic cast. We had Tim McInerney, Chris Ryan, Sophie Thompson, hope I don't forget anyone, Celia Imrie. Amazing audio cast. But it was Big Finish who do... I don't know if you know them, don't you?
Yeah, I did. I had my head... Crushed by a Cyberman, which is in one of their... they do Doctor Who audio adventures.
Yes.
It was not real. People are worried. My head's fine. It was quite an active job to work out what sound you would make as your head was crushed by a Cyberman, but I think I nailed it.
I was an arachnid person, so I had to find a voice that was for the spider people.
Right.
Yeah. So they're great fun.
Yeah.
And I showed them the very first draft of the book, and they said, "Yeah, make a drama of this." But it is only one sort of slice of the whole story, and the story is expanded in the book. There's a lot more characters, and his aunt is a very important person in it. Oh, somebody's
so it's kicking off over there. There's people. Yeah. It's the Big Finish. So it's a great speak. Are you everything okay? Okay. You can shut up now. Now you've got a chance to voice your... No? Okay. Is it a fight? Is someone filming? Oh, that's naughty. This is what emergency questions are for.
What have you got there?
These are my emergency questions. They're for when there's an emergency in the show. Doesn't happen very often. I can deflect. Got to try to get one that will deflect and not be too weird. If you could go into a chrysalis and come out of the chrysalis as anything you wanted to be, what would you choose to emerge from a chrysalis as? Nigel Planer.
Oh.
Yeah.
Anything I wanted to be.
But what would you dream of being if you weren't you? You can be anything. You can be another person. You can be another thing.
Oof. That's too... Yeah. I'd probably chicken out and say I'll be me because...
That's good.
Because you could make a terrible mistake.
Well, you know...
Couldn't you?
Do you think caterpillars regret becoming butterflies? Think any butterflies look back? It was much better when I was down in the shit, grubbing around for food, eating my way through lots of fruit and leaves.
It could be bad, though, you know, like back on your heads in the hell, like that, you know.
That's a very good answer, I think, Nigel. I feel this is my therapy question.
Yeah,
and
go
I think
on.
To say to for someone to say I'd like to come out as myself as I am now. I mean, that's
I didn't
a,
say
that's
as
a...
I am now.
I'd like to come back in the new improved version.
All right. Yeah. Well, there you go. So already, would you be younger? Would you be fitter? Would you be?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. What is the ideal age to be Nigel Plain?
Ah, what's the ideal age? 40.
40. Ooh. Yeah. I would choose 40 as well. 40 was
would
when
you?
I well that's when I met my wife, but also I was, you know, I was at the height of my powers, I think, at 40.
Yeah.
I don't think my wife would have, you know, she's regretting it now 16 years on. When she realizes that, you know, I'm an old man. But
40, you've got some wisdom. If you go back before then, you're still dumb, aren't you?
Yeah.
Whereas at 40, you've gained a little bit of wisdom, not too much, and you're still you still have your physical powers and all that. No, 40, I'd come back as me at 40.
40-year-old Nigel Plain at 1990.
Not like the real me is 40, because I was in a terrible mood. Well, yeah. New improved Nigel at a new improved 40.
So you'd come out as yourself at a time in your life where you were messed up.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. That's
no, future 40.
Very, very good answer. I'll do one more and then we'll go back to your career. Which part of your life... I don't know if I've asked anyone this. Which part of your life do you look back on and think, what the fuck was I thinking? Sort of the same question, maybe, as we just started.
Yeah. There's a lot of it.
Is I mean, it?
There's a I lot. Do. Don't most people... Surely, a lot... Like a lot.
And pretty much all the time, 2 years on, I look back. There was a point in the early 2000s where I didn't wash my hair for 2 years. I look back and go, what was I thinking of that? There was a theory that, you know, your hair becomes self-cleaning.
Oh, doesn't. Yes.
Doesn't. Fucking
I
doesn't.
I remember that.
And but I still persisted with it. I don't know how I got any sex in the year 2000 to 2002.
But I tried but that. I tried that for a few weeks.
Okay, give it a go.
Yeah.
No.
No. No, absolutely not. What was the question again?
What part of your life... Which part of your life do you most look back on and think, what the fuck was I thinking? I mean, most people would be teenagers, maybe, but I don't know. I keep making mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, there's just... It's pockets all the way through. Quite often.
Yeah.
Probably last week, you know, last month. What's that expression? Too often, too small to mention, but too often to just, you know, forget.
Yeah. But look, a lot of middle-aged men and later middle-aged men go kind of a little bit crazy in lots of ways. Like, you know, and it feels to me like you're still you. And you're still, I think the 30, 40-year-old you wouldn't look at you and go, oh, no, what have you become?
No, maybe not, but I have become quite grumpy, you know, shouting at the telly.
Yeah.
My wife used to sort of really get annoyed with me for talking through the telly and criticising everybody and everything on the telly. And she'd say, I'm going to watch it on my own then, if you're going to make all this noise. And yesterday or the day before, she was watching the telly and I went into the other room and I heard her shouting at the telly. Yes! She was going, oh, that's ridiculous.
What I do that annoys my wife is that if I'm watching anything from like 30 years ago or more, I go through Wikipedia and tell her who's dead. Oh. Yep. I was looking at The Sound of Music, the kids in The Sound of Music. Some of them are still here. It's like, we don't. Julie Andrews has done incredible, and Dick Van Dyke, probably by the time this goes out, they'll both be dead. But it's... Mary Poppins had an incredible... They had a couple of early deaths. One very sad one. But, you know, Dick Van Dyke and Julie Andrews and... what's her name, Millicent... the woman who played the Votes for Women. She's only just died, that lady. She,
Millicent Martin.
It wasn't Millicent Martin. No. I can't know.
All right.
What was the name of the mother in Mary Poppins? Wikipedia?
Have you got your...
Edit point. Phyllis Johns, that was it. I nearly got it, didn't I? Nearly got there. Thank you. That's my producer who has Wikipedia ready for. In the old days, this audience, you ask them a question, honestly, bang, someone would know it straight away. My audience has got a lot thicker. It's in the last... We've been doing this for 13 years, this show. They've got older, they've got thicker. They're not like they got the good old days. So, one of the plays you've written with Adrian... Now, have you just changed the title of one of these plays, or is it the same play? Because there was a play called Vulcan...
There was a play called Vulcan 7, which Adrian and I wrote together, and then we toured it.
Yeah.
Playing these two old actors, or middle-aged actors, which is why we're no longer playing them. And it was called Vulcan 7. It's about two actors in a Winnebago on the side of a volcano in Iceland, and their route of escape is cut off, and they're stuck with each other. It's a bit sort of Waiting for Godot-y.
Yep.
And they're there with the runner, the woman who's the runner. She's 21 years old. It's her birthday. And they reckon, while they're stuck there and getting a bit drunk, that either one of them might be her dad.
Okay.
That's the kind of twist in the plot. Anyway, it is the same play, but it's not the same play because, again, as with any project, I believe in this sort of concept of fluid text where things take a while to develop and at some point they print it, but... Or sometimes, you put the production out. We came back after that. We were rewriting all the way on the tour. We came back home afterwards. We rewrote it again quite substantially. The girl's part is now much bigger. And we renamed it It's Headed Straight Towards Us, which is a better title than Vulcan 7 and also is clearer about what the story is. People thought, coming to see it, that it was a science fiction thing. It was going to be a science fiction. And so it's the same, and yet it's not the same. It's better.
Yeah.
And we've got some proper actors in to play the parts now. So we've got some really good people to play us. We found that with the two of us on stage, acting it in theatres around the country, there was an expectation that it would be like Bottom, or that there would be, some shouting and swearing and physical comedy. And that was a sort of disconnect with the audience because it's a very funny play, but it's also a very moving play. I mean, it's got sad bits too, and it's a proper play. And so we thought what we've got to do to solve this, A, we've got to rewrite it, retitle it, and we've got to get some proper actors in who are the right age, because it's also... We're more old enough to be this girl's grandparents.
Yeah.
So it was a bit sad, two old blokes on stage.
Yeah.
Whereas we've got Samuel West is playing the part that I played, and Rufus Hound is playing the part that Adrian played.
Amazing,
and it's going on at the Park Theatre in Finsbury Park in September.
Terrific. That's great. I mean, this is like an amazing, creative burst, it seems. I know both these projects have been going on for a little while, but they're sort of coming to fruition at the same time. And those sound like quite different projects.
Yeah, they are different. Yeah. There's a third one that's been brewing for 50 years, which is coming out in September.
Wow, okay.
And I'm going on tour with Henry Normal. Do you know Henry Normal?
Yeah.
He was a poet first, comedian poet, and I went on tour with him in the 90s.
Did you?
As a performance poet.
Yes.
And then he took over Steve Coogan's company, the production company. And he ran that and wrote for Steve Coogan for 25 years.
Yeah.
Then he's resigned from that. He's back into poetry and invited me out on tour with him again. So, and he said, you've got to have a book this time. You've got to have a poetry collection. Now we're going out together. So he put me in touch with his poetry publisher, who said, yeah, we'll do a collection of your poetry. So I went, I went back to the files thinking, yeah, sure. And I've got a poetry collection coming out, and I put dates on them all because I've gone back. The first poem, actually, I put them in reverse order.
Okay.
So it's like a memoir in poetry, in poems, that goes back. So one that was written this year is 2023, and it goes back, and the first one's 1970.
Wow.
So all those, you know, those terrible things you wrote when you were a teenager, yeah, they're in there.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And are they serious, especially the teenage ones, are they earnest and serious, or are they comedic?
They're both. Yeah. There's some which are just comedic, because yeah, when I was... Originally, they were all very heartfelt and and embarrassing.
Yeah.
But then I didn't... they're not too bad. I did... You know, I used to get published in magazines and in collections and things.
Yeah.
When I started to go on tour with Henry, I started to put more comic ones in because it makes for a better evening. You know, you don't want to go, here's a... you know, mumble, mumble. So I kind of go between the two.
Yeah.
And... So there's comic and there's non-comic.
Yeah, but the, you know, this is it's an incredible. I mean, you're still acting, you're still writing. You know, this is and doing all these varied things. It's, you've got to feel like, you know,
this year I am feeling like that. But these things, I'm feeling good because I think this is great. We've got the book and the play and the poem. This is fantastic, you know. But all of these things, as you said, they represent about 10 years' work each.
Yeah.
And those 10 years
have been hard,
but yeah, I mean, they have in a way, because you're writing. If you've written many drafts of something again and again, and nobody's paid you, and nobody's said, "Hey, that's good," and you've gone and tried to get people to put it on, and they don't even answer your emails. I mean, this is the reality. The same as everybody else. They're not. It is quite hard to sort of think, no, I'll give that another draft. I'll have another go. I've got a film script which finally I've found a director for, and I looked at the files just yesterday, and I think I started writing it in 2008, and I think I've written 26 drafts of it now. I've been through two or three producers. We still haven't raised the money, but it's good. At least the satisfaction is it's good now. I can read it again. And I've shown it to a few people now, and I think, no, it works. That's the satisfaction.
Yeah.
If anybody made this, it works. The script actually works, and that's taken years to get there.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, in a sense, you know, I think sometimes people, again, reach a level where everything they do gets made, right, straight away. And,
yeah.
And then they don't put in they don't do 26 drafts of anything. They do one draft or something if you're lucky. And sometimes they just turn up and go, let's see what we come up with today. And so, like, by having that period, by having, like, even if it's a, you know, it's not a wilderness period because you've been working for the last 10 years as well, because I've seen your IMDb page, so you've still been acting.
Yeah.
But even if you would call it a wilderness, if you can call, like, your 60s a wilderness period, because most people are thinking about not carrying on working at that stage, not performers, but most people who aren't performers would think, well, I'm getting ready to retire and, you know, spend the rest of my life playing Scrabble, which I'm looking forward to. So, you know, that's, you know, the fact you've done 26 versions of each of these things is what makes them great, and that's why they're, you know, because you've...
Well, I hope so. I think it's more fun. It's really satisfying if you can get something right every now and then. That's better than Scrabble.
But it was
a retirement occupation.
Yeah.
To sit with yourself and be researching something, because usually I like to write things. I'm very sort of historically motivated.
Yeah.
And to be doing that, and especially if it's funny.
Yeah.
And then you're giggling to yourself because you think, oh, this is funny, or making Adrian laugh, which is even better, you know.
Well, it's true. I really love the idea of you two working together because, you know, it's nice to have that continuum of the two of you still being, you know, creative together, but equally for both of you. I mean, it's so far away from where you started as well. I have to say that was one of the impressive things about the Jeremiah Bourne in time is that you've obviously researched the 1910s and you haven't really researched the 2100s very well, I don't think, but the 1910s, you know, there's lots about language, isn't there? Certainly in the radio play of the way people talk and how different it would be for someone from now to go back even 100 years. You would almost, you know, you're talking a different language.
I'm going to have a problem next. They've put the first of three of a trilogy.
Yeah, that's what I noticed that.
They put that on the cover. Thanks very much. No, I've got... But I do have a plan for the second one, and the language is a problem because I want to investigate, go back to 1666, around the time of the Fire of London, and the Royal Society, and Isaac Newton, and Robert Hooke, and they had a copyright battle between them over the ideas. And I want to go back then, but it's quite difficult to imagine how would they talk, and then to think, and how can I make it funny as well, you know, because you want to have character voices talking. 1910 is not so difficult. It's not that far removed from the way we talk.
No.
But if you're writing for 1666, how did they talk then, really? And what can I get away with in terms of making it funny?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that's interesting. But there was a news article on BBC News about a woman who'd lived in the same house for 105 years, which is sort of basically almost exactly the timeline of this book.
Of what I'm saying.
So she was born in the house and she's 105 years old. She's lived in the house her whole life.
Yeah.
But she was talking about how, you know, there was one gas light, you had to put a penny in it. It's amazing how much time has changed. You know, how much has changed in that 100 years. It's almost, I mean, there's not been 100 years in human history where as much has changed, I would say, as the last 100. So I would say, though 1910 and 1666 are going to be quite a long way apart.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
But you know
what I mean?
That's what struck me about it was how different 1910 was. Like, you know, you
so
think,
just
oh, 19-
got to be careful not to go back to the great vowel shift. Have you ever heard of that? That is like pre-Chaucer.
Yeah.
Chaucer time, there was something called the great vowel shift, when suddenly all the vowels changed their sounds and nobody knows why, I think. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I won't go back before the great vowel
shift. You might
have
to. If you're doing three books, you might have to
climb. Oh, yeah. Or go back further and do it all in Latin.
Yeah.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? Yeah.
But you know, that it's a real piece of work already. So if you do three of them, it's going to be, you know, that's what's impressive about it. And I think that's what I'm trying to say in this conversation is, you know, what this 10 years you've spent working on all these projects has been an important creative time that, you know, again, if people had been falling over themselves 10 years ago to produce all of these things, you might just have, you know, put out something that wasn't
absolutely as good. Absolutely right.
So you know, there's speaking in person as well. There's an element where you think, oh, I wish, you know, the scripts I've been writing over the last 20 years had been made into anything. But equally, you're learning every time you.
Yeah,
do
you
that.
Do. And you do learn you every time. And I always like to remember, you know, Madame Bovary, the novel by Flaubert.
I'm aware of it.
Yes. He wrote the first draft, very famous novel, French turn of the century. He wrote the first draft, wasn't quite happy with it, and he didn't get round to the second draft for another 25 years.
Right.
But he must have been, you know, tinkering at it all of that time. Things like that keep me going. Well, if Flaubert waited 25 years, then I'm just a beginner here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, all this... It does. I mean, you are, can I tell them how old you are? You're 70
years
old.
Yes, I'm 70.
Which is, you know, and you don't, you know, you don't seem.
This is great. I love coming on
you
this.
You don't
show.
See a day.
It's been,
I'd have said.
His angles are so good.
I'd have said 67.
You're brilliant.
67, 68. So you're doing amazingly well.
Yeah. I got a couple of years on it.
No. You know, it's like you say, a lot of people would be stopping working, but I think by carrying on working, you know, it keeps life vivid. And this is very philosophical, this book. It's, you know, it sounds like the players as well. How do we find out about the Henry Normal tour? Is there somewhere where the date... Have you got a website where the dates are up or...
I have got a website, but I haven't put the dates up on my website. Should.
You will have done by the time this... We can travel into the future now.
Yeah.
And change... We can change the past so the people listening to at home can go to... Have you got a website? Is it your own website? NigelPlainer.com? .co.uk?
.co.uk, yeah. I'll put the dates up on there. Henry Normal has a website.
Yes.
And our dates are up on that.
Okay.
I'm just sort of hitching a ride with Henry, really. Literally, because I think he's going to do the driving. I hope he is.
Well, it's, you know, what a... that's a terrific night of two fantastic performers, really interesting people. We haven't had Henry on here. Must get Henry on.
Yeah, especially now he's back performing.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was about 20 years he was a businessman.
Yeah, I mean, he must have made a lot of money.
One hopes. Yeah.
Hopefully he's financing the tour.
Yes.
You get £1 million a gig. Well, look, we haven't got too much longer. There was a lot of things. There's loads of stuff we haven't talked about. We've done too. You wrote the Not the 9 o'clock News sketch about That's Life. Don't know if I mentioned that.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that
sketch.
That's
years ago.
I know, but you and Peter.
Me and Peter, but it was also my brother Roger and his mate Mark Smith.
Right.
Who used to work at LBC when it first started. It was the four of us who wrote the sketch, really. Because my brother Roger used to write for Mel Smith and Griff Rhys-Jones and Radioactive on the radio. He was a BBC comedy writer.
Yeah.
So, four writers. But it sells well, that 9 o'clock news stuff.
Does it?
At the time, yes, we couldn't believe it. We got actual money.
Are you still getting 4p every 6 months from it?
No, I think it's long gone now. But at the time, when they sold the album of it, we were shocked. It was because when you write, as my brother did for BBC comedy, the money was terrible. Terrible, terrible. You know, so much for a minute. If we like the minute, we'll give you £4 kind of... It was really... Have you ever done that?
I didn't. We wrote Weekending, which was...
Weekending, that's the one.
£20. Yeah. I think we got £20 a minute by the time I was doing it.
Right.
Oh, but, well, you know, there was a... If you didn't get anything on, you didn't get any money. That's so there was like 8 weeks where...
So they weren't commissioning... When they said, we'll commission, half an hour of material off you...
Yeah.
If you wrote 1 minute out of that they liked, you only got paid for 1 minute.
Yeah.
So, it's terrible.
But I find that... I love the idea of not 9 o'clock news being connected to the young... You know, I love all those connections. And Paul Jackson was the guy who commissioned us to do... I think This Morning with Rich Not Judy. He was a big... And You Can Choose Your Friends, which I did on ITV when he was there. He was a big supporter of Stuart and my stuff.
So, was he? Was
yeah,
he?
So it was kind of really... I love that, you know, those connections that go through... The decades with comedy. So it's nice to know that you were, you know, involved with Not the Night.
Not the Night. Well, first night of the comic strip club, we had as our sort of guest star, because we had our act, but we wanted to make it a starry, spraunty night.
Yeah.
We had Pamela Stevenson was top of the bill on the first night of the comic strip. Because we all knew each other. I can't think why or... where you met them. You know, in the 80s, there was an awful lot of... All the different comedy groups, you'd all bump into each other all the time.
Well, we won't go crazily into this because there isn't time, but it was... I mean, it's a time that Stuart always goes on about being an amazing time, and he did that show where he curated a lot of his favourite acts from the 80s,
which you were involved in.
But he always talks about the Iceman, who I interviewed for the book club. He's written a book. Do you remember the Iceman? He used to... It might have been slightly later than the early 80s.
I don't remember the Iceman. I remember the guy who put a firework up his ass.
Chris Lynham.
Yes.
He's been a guest on the podcast. So yeah,
has he? Really, yeah.
Yeah, occasionally got burnt.
Yes.
Seriously injured.
And the Greatest Show on Legs.
Yeah.
Who did a striptease with balloons, popping balloons. There were some really terrible acts, weren't there? including ourselves, you know.
Well, it was, you know, but it felt like there was a lot of madness going on. There was a lot of people. Even when I started doing stand-up, that you couldn't really tell the difference between, you couldn't be sure if it was a comedian or just someone who'd wandered off the street, and, you know. But then very quickly it became a much more sort of professional, you know.
When did that happen? I think it became professional as soon as we left.
Right.
Because meaning the comic strip group, but we weren't very professional. And then I remember meeting somebody who said, oh, no, I'm doing my comedy. And I left university in order to do comedy as if it was a career choice.
Yeah.
As if doing this, you know, and I remember thinking, oh, this has gone very, you know, commercial and also very lucrative for those other people. Where did we go wrong?
Yeah, it's like football, isn't it? The early footballers didn't make much and now these guys are making millions. But not all of them.
Where do you place yourself in this spectrum?
I'm sort of that, you know, but influenced by you guys and by that whole scene, but again, by the guys in the 60s as well. I went to university hoping to do comedy more than anything else and then came out of university wanting to do comedy. But it's still, at that point, that was the late 80s, early 90s, and it still wasn't like, oh, you know, this will be a lucrative career. You thought I might.
But was it Footlights? Were you at that?
I was in Oxford Review.
Oxford Review. Yeah. So it was similar to how it had been.
Yeah.
It was just Oxbridge, wasn't it?
Well, and it was a lot, yeah. But after the 80s,
that opened up. Manchester University, with all the Rick and Aid and Ben, all came from Manchester University.
Yeah. And we haven't got time to go into it. But in the late 80s. Going up to Edinburgh as part of the Oxford Review was not a pleasant experience. It scarred the rest of my life. Because the battle had been won already by then. But it was the battle had been won.
I think
alternative comedy had sort of overthrown the student review. Like this, there are people who still come out of Oxford and Cambridge, but it was at the time there wasn't. Luck. I was in a period where Armando Iannucci, Stuart Lee, Al Murray, Sally Phillips. There was a lot of good people in our period, but there hadn't been anyone since Rowan Atkinson really before that.
I remember seeing an interview with Armando Iannucci and I can't remember his name, the guy who used to do hour-long interviews, in-depth interviews on telly, media pundit, and Armando saying, well, I came out of Oxford, you know, and, you know, it was just such a black mark on me. You know, I couldn't get arrested. I couldn't get a job as a comedian. If he wanted to go into comedy, it would have all gone with all those other alternative people by then. And we're all going, come on.
Really? It's sort of a bit of both. I think, you know, but Armando Iannucci is like the...
He's a genius.
Absolutely genius. And it felt like coming out, if there was, you know, I did the Edinburgh Fringe in 88... And we did Late and Live, and we were heckled by every single comedian. I was 19 or 20 years old, and it was apps. And then Keith Allen,
he's a spoiler anyway.
So I had a very very unpleasant time. That was, you know, I should go into therapy about.
Yeah.
But maybe now is the time I should talk to you about it, but we won't. We won't talk about. We're not here to talk about me, and we're not here to talk about
it's
you
quite
anymore.
Interesting though, it just got interesting.
It did just get interesting, but I've got to do another. I've got to wait till
you've
next
got
week.
Important guests.
Yeah,
on,
I've got other guests to come, but it means, Nigel, you can come back another time because we've still loads we didn't. Absolutely fantastic to see you. These people love you. And rightly so. Welcome, the amazing Nigel Planer. Thank you. You have been listening to Rahulastapur with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Nigel Planer. The music is by Scat Regard. I am indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. Thank you also to Chris Evans, not that one, for walking around creepily behind my chair as I am recording these credits. I think it was him. Thank you to everyone at Sky Potato and everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre. Thank you also to Catherine McKeegan for the excellent Rahulastapur. Rahulastapur.com. Check it out if you want to know a lot of information about this show. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and Go Faster Stripe.com production.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.